From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Memorial Day edition of Fresh Air, the story of wounded soldiers and their doctors at the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Iraq. We talk with filmmakers John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill about their documentary Baghdad ER, which will be shown tonight on HBO. It's an unflinching look at the injuries of war that also shows the bravery of the soldiers and the dedication of the doctors. Also, war photographer David Douglas Duncan describes the pictures he took for Life magazine during the Korean War, pictures he hoped would serve as photographic headstones for the soldiers. The Marine Corps gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award for excellence and bravery for his work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Memorial Day, we're going to hear the story of wounded soldiers and their doctors at the 86th Combat Support Hospital, the Army's premier medical facility in Iraq. The hospital is the subject of the new documentary Baghdad ER, which debuted on HBO last week and will be shown again this evening. It was shot over the course of 2 months in 2005. My guests are the filmmakers John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. Alpert, the senior member of the duo, has won 12 Emmy Awards for his documentaries. Over 2,000 Americans have been killed in Iraq since March 2003, but over 17,000 have been wounded. This film graphically shows the condition of wounded soldiers, many of whom have had limbs blown off or amputated as a result of IEDs, improvised explosive devices. Here's a short scene from the film in which we hear two wounded soldiers at the hospital calling home to break the news.
Hey, Mom.
Hey, how are you?
Captain
Lambertson.
I'm in the hospital.
Where?
I don't know where the hell I am. I'm in a hospital somewhere. Yeah, I got hit by an IED today. I'm not too bad considering the way the vehicle looked.
Hey, honey. How you doing? I'm doing, you know, fine, but guess what? I got hit with IED. Well, I was gunning. And, you know, all it did was, I was on top of the vehicle, like where Davis is at. And all I heard was the explosion. It happened so fast.
John Alpert, Matthew O'Neill, welcome to Fresh Air. John, why did you want to make a movie about an emergency room, about a combat hospital in Baghdad?
I thought it might be a way to be able to show both the horror of war, which I think people really always need to know about if a country is at war, and also the heroism of the people that we're sending over there to fight that war. I thought we might find those two things intersecting in the emergency room of the hospital in Baghdad.
Would you describe the combat hospital that you ended up filming?
Yeah, it's easier for us to describe in words because we weren't allowed to film the exterior for security purposes. That was one of the conditions of our embedded agreement, that we couldn't do anything that compromised the safety of the soldiers, and we followed that agreement to the letter. The Army's obligation on their part was to give us total access to the hospital, and they followed that to the letter. This is a hospital that's not very big. It has an emergency room that has four beds in it, and it has an operating room that has four beds in it. And sometimes you can't fit all the people in, and the helicopters keep coming. The bodies are loaded off the helicopter with limbs dangling and blood spurting out, and it's one of the most frightening things I've ever seen in my life, but also one of the most heroic when you see these doctors go to work to try to save lives.
You show a lot of violence in the film, and you don't show the violence, you show the results of violence. You're showing a part of war that the public is usually protected from, a part that soldiers are often reluctant to talk about when they return home. And I'm referring to really grotesque open wounds, amputations. We see part of an amputation. We see one of the doctors or perhaps a nurse taking a removed limb and discarding it in a special trash bag. How did you decide how graphic you would allow the film to be?
We actually decided that we couldn't show the reality of that hospital because it was too graphic. If you've never seen an amputation, it's something that scars you forever, and we backed way off. The first cut of this program was so violent that it sent people screaming out of the room. And we wanted to show the reality of war, but we just couldn't. And the soldiers are actually surprised because they said, "Wow, this is nothing compared to what was going on there every single day. You're just showing the pinky on an amputated hand." And we just had to do that because we wanted people to be able to get through the whole program and to be able to understand the horror of the war without saying, "I can't watch this," and tuning in an American Idol program instead.
When you were actually in the hospital shooting, were you shooting everything, and did you decide that later you would figure out what was too graphic and what you wanted to include, but in the meantime, you'd shoot it all.
We shot more than 200 hours of tape over the time that we were embedded with the 86th Combat Support Hospital, and there was no way we could ever share the volume of surgeries, amputations, cranial injuries, the volume of horror that we saw through our cameras. And really what we tried to capture was the essence of the challenges these doctors face every day and boil it down so that the audience could feel like they were in the center of this hospital, that they understood both the horror they confronted and their day-to-day lives.
When you see any person come in a shape that really doesn't look like a person anymore, dismembered and bleeding, it's very, very hard to take. And for a moment, you don't know how you're going to be able to do this. But we had a job to do. It's the same job that the doctors had. We can't stitch anybody back together again, and we're not soldiers. We don't know how to fire a gun, but we do know how to hold cameras. And our job was to hold a camera up to that reality and make sure we brought that back. There have not been a lot of images of this type of thing coming back from Iraq. And it was really clear to us that the Army wants people to see this. They gave us permission to go there. They let us stay there. They helped us. And when they saw the film, they thanked us.
Yes, but at the same time, there's been a little bit more negative reaction subsequent to that. The Pentagon, from my reading of the newspapers, cut back its participation in a screening of the movie. A couple of the top people declined at the last minute to go, and military spokespeople expressed their concern that the movie could lead to post-traumatic stress symptoms on the part of soldiers who watched it. The Secretary of the Army declined to attend a screening. Another reaction on the part of the military is that the movie could be demoralizing. Were you surprised to hear those responses?
Well, the response we've heard from every person who wears a uniform, that's from the chief of staff of the Army on down to every private that's seen the film, has been nothing but positive and supportive. So I think the Surgeon General's right to be concerned about post-traumatic stress syndrome. I think we all need to be concerned about post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I think that this film will help Americans understand some of the images, some of the flashbacks that our soldiers may be suffering through. Because you see both the physical anguish and the mental anguish here. And I think it's important for everyone to understand that the soldiers are coming back with, as one soldier says in the film, wounds on the outside and wounds on the inside.
Yeah, and if you don't mind me adding something, we consulted with a number of psychiatrists about this. And what they told us and what we believe and what the soldiers told us is that post-traumatic stress doesn't come from television programs. It comes from war. And it comes from what you experience over there. And that's what needs to be treated and is being treated by the Army. But to pretend that there is a war without blood, that there's a war without amputation and a war without death, is more dangerous than anything we might be doing.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you witness up close in the movie is the vulnerability, the frailty of the human body. I mean, we see bodies really torn up. And I guess I wonder if you asked yourself, is during a war a bad time to be focusing on how vulnerable the human body is in war?
I don't think there's a more appropriate time to focus on the vulnerability of the human body. I mean, this film shows you the horror of what man can do to man. And it's important to recognize that any war, and this war in particular, involve a lot of frail human bodies getting hurt by very crude instruments of destruction. You know, these IEDs are put together with spit and bubble gum wrapped around nails and whatever other detritus that the insurgents can find to create a bomb. And that's part of the reason why the wounds are so dangerous and so many infections come from them, because they're not coming in with bullet wounds. They're coming in literally exploded, blown up.
Could you talk a little bit more about why these wounds are so problematic to treat?
When the soldiers come in injured from an IED attack, they often don't look like people anymore, because as I said, the improvised explosive devices are put together sometimes from garbage. So they cause all sorts of horrific infections. And that's part of the reason that the combat support hospital works so hard to get the soldiers out of the war zone as quickly as possible. One of the things that I found very interesting was the speed with which they would move a soldier from the site of his injury all the way out to Landstuhl, Germany, where they have their first-class, first-world medical facility. And you could get injured on a street in Baghdad and in less than 10 hours be in a German hospital.
It was interesting because you can actually get better and faster care in Baghdad if you're a soldier than if you're somebody like me in New York City. I rode up and down Route Irish, the most dangerous road in the world, and was lucky enough not to get hurt. Flying around in Black Hawk helicopters, didn't get hurt, come back to New York City and crashed my motorcycle a block from my house and broke my foot in four places. And it took me longer to get to the hospital there than it takes for them to pick up somebody in the field and get them into the Baghdad ER. And that's really amazing. The resources that are put to try and save the lives of not only American soldiers, but injured Iraqis, and in many cases, the people who are trying to kill our soldiers, the enemies of our soldiers, is just amazing. And the hospital was filled with as many Iraqis as they had wounded soldiers.
My guests are John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill, the directors of the HBO documentary Baghdad ER. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. Their documentary Baghdad ER will be shown tonight on HBO. They shot the film over the course of 2 months at the Army's 86th Combat Support Hospital in Baghdad. What did you have to do to get permission from the doctors to film in the hospital? Or did they have to give you your permission? And what about the soldiers? I mean, you have soldiers in the beginning of the film, you have soldiers being wheeled in on gurneys naked, with their bodies torn up from these IED explosions. Did they give their permission before or after?
Every soldier you see receiving care in this film by the 86 CASH signed a release.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors and the hospital staff and the soldiers themselves were all very rightfully proud of the work that's going on at the Combat Support Hospital. And so they were, in most cases, eager to do so. On Monday night, we screened the film down in Washington with a number of the soldiers who were in the film and with a number of the doctors from the CASH. And one soldier came up to me afterwards, and I had been very nervous about him seeing the film for the first time because he's one of those soldiers that you see in a very tender, very emotional moment after having lost one of his comrades. And when I asked him to sign the release in Baghdad, he hesitated, and he said, "Are you guys going to use this for a politically manipulative film? Is this going to be another Fahrenheit 9-1-1? And I promised him that it wouldn't be. And I promised him that we would take a completely objective point of view and it would be an apolitical film. But I never knew how he would feel about sharing that moment with a national audience. And he came up to me after the film and he thanked me because he said that we did it. We managed not to have a political bent on this film. And then his comrade who was there with him in the hospital said, "And you know what? I think it's important for Americans to know that sometimes soldiers cry."
Well, you know, I'm really glad you brought this up because I think there's two times in the movie when soldiers cry. And both of those times, they're crying because of the death of a buddy. Nobody in the movie's crying over themselves. The soldiers are so stoic about their own injuries. I just found it amazing when you look at what's happening to their bodies, and they're just dealing with it. It was just remarkable to me.
Before we went over, every commander we spoke to in the Army would tell us that we would be shocked how every soldier that got injured, the first thing he would do is ask to go back.
Yeah, and you show that. You show that. There's a guy who's got shrapnel in his eye. He might be blinded forever in that eye. And when the surgeon tells him that they're going to have to send him to the United States or Germany for the surgery, he looks very, I mean, he's controlling his disappointment and anger because he doesn't want to leave. And that too was very surprising to me.
And that soldier is actually back in Iraq. He, through modern military medicine, he regained all of his eyesight. And a couple of months ago, I called his home, hoping to speak to him to see how he was doing. And I got his wife on the line, and she said to me, "Oh, no, you know, he got 20/20 vision." And I said, "That's fantastic." And there was silence. She said, "Well, now he's in Kuwait on his way back to Baghdad." And it's interesting. These guys who are getting patched up after horrific injuries really are doing everything in their power to get back into the fight. And really, I think, to get back to their buddies, because the bonds that they form with each other are very, very strong.
Yeah, there were a couple of things that really surprised me about our experience in Iraq. And one was the adhesion that the soldiers have for each other. And when you're over in Iraq, it's not a pleasant environment. It's 130 degrees. It's 140 degrees. There are people waiting around almost every corner to blow you up into little pieces. And in many cases, if you ask the soldiers what they're fighting for, maybe they don't even know. But their buddy is next to them. Their buddy is there to protect them. And you're going through this together, and you cannot let your buddy down.
They're fighting for each other.
Yeah.
What kind of training did the doctors at this combat hospital have? They're called on to do things. The medicine's just really different than what you'd be doing, say, at an emergency room in the United States. I mean, as you've described, you have these IEDs with horrible pieces of filthy shrapnel, and then there's a lot of amputations that are performed. What kind of training do they have before they actually get there?
In many cases, unfortunately, there is nothing that can prepare anyone for what they wind up encountering. It's like being dropped off into the middle of the chainsaw massacre, and there's nothing that can prepare you for that. And the doctors say that how in the world can you prepare somebody to amputate two legs and two arms every single day? You can't. There's no training for it. And often there's no cure for the disturbances that you suffer except that you know that you're doing the right thing and that you're helping people. And that's what gets them through it. They wake up in the morning knowing that they're going to save somebody's life that day, and it helps them deal with the really scary things that come in the door.
And the unfortunate fact that they'll probably lose someone that day, too.
You know, you told us a little bit about getting the permission of the doctors and of the injured soldiers. Was it hard to get permission from the military to make the movie in the first place?
The military was astonishingly cooperative. We became officially embedded, and there's a 13-page embedded agreement that has some fine print in it, but basically it boiled down to just a couple of very simple things. We couldn't do anything to compromise the security of any of the installations and the security of the soldiers. So in this film, you won't see any nice exteriors. You have really no idea where the hospital is located. And that's to make it difficult for people to drive bombs into the hospital. And our obligation to the Army was to give them the film so that they could look at it and comment on it, but not so they could censor it. We weren't obligated to do anything in reaction to their viewing. And the Army was obligated to facilitate our trip, to give us access, to feed us, to protect us. And in the almost 40 years of filmmaking, I have never received such cooperation from anyone. They let us film anything we wanted. The only thing we couldn't film were some of the enemy combatants who came into the hospital. And that's only because the Geneva Convention doesn't allow you to parade prisoners in front of cameras. Otherwise, they would have let us film it.
But let me stop you there. So the doctors were treating enemy combatants?
A lot of them. You know, I mean, I got really excited because this was one of the few different things that happened. You know, normally you hear the chuck, 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 chuck from the helicopters, and you go, oh, gosh, here it comes again. And in comes a half of a body on a gurney with somebody desperately pumping on their chest trying to keep them alive. But one day, this guy in an orange jumpsuit came in. He was manacled hand, manacled feet, and he had these really weird goggles on. And I said, whoa, this is different. I go, you know, running across the room with my camera, almost got tackled by the public affairs officer. And I said, oh, gosh, why don't they want me to film this? And she explained, this is an enemy combatant, and the Geneva Convention does not allow us to let you take pictures of him. But there were a lot of them. And it's really strange. You'll have on one bed an American soldier who was blown into smithereens, desperately trying to keep this guy alive. And on the other bed is the guy that was trying to kill him. And they're trying to save both of these guys' lives, and they're working just as hard on both of them. That was amazing.
How did the doctors feel about that?
I think they had some pretty complicated emotions when it came right down to it. It didn't stop them from doing their best job professionally, but I think it was one of the more difficult things that they wrestled with. I remember one operating room nurse telling me that after a certain insurgent came in and they saved his life, and they saved his life by replacing the blood he had lost with American blood, with the blood that they had in their blood bank there. And she said that she waited until that insurgent woke up and she grabbed one of the translators because she wanted him to know that the blood that had saved his life had been the blood of American soldiers.
John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill directed the documentary Baghdad ER. It will be shown again tonight on HBO. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill about their documentary Baghdad ER. Also, a celebrated war photographer recalls the images of soldiers' faces he captured during the Korean War. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Memorial Day, we're talking about the documentary Baghdad ER, which was shot over the course of 2 months in 2005 at the 86th Combat Support Hospital in Iraq. The film premiered last week on HBO and will be shown again this evening. My guests are the directors John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. Here's another scene from the documentary in which a wounded soldier in the hospital is visited by a major general.
Special Spurlock, one of the things we don't like to do is see anybody hurt. If we issue a Purple Heart, It's one of the nation's richest, most valued and respected award given to those that are injured in combat. Be proud to wear this for the rest of your life. On behalf of the president and a grateful nation, okay, I present you the Purple Heart. All right. For wounds received in combat, all right? Your mission? Get better, huh? So get better quick, all right? And we'll see you soon, huh?
Oh, sure.
Okay. All right.
You know, that's one award I never wanted to see you get.
There's an image, and this isn't at all gory, this image I'm about to describe, but it really sticks with me. You know, I always thought that when a wounded soldier gets a Purple Heart, that in my mind it was always like, after they'd recovered a little bit and they're wearing their military uniform, that the Purple Heart is then pinned on the uniform. That was the image always in my mind. In your movie, you show a man who's on the gurney. He's just been injured. He's not wearing clothes. He's bare-chested. And the Purple Heart is just placed on his bare chest. And he might still be kind of in shock because he's not showing a lot of emotion. And I just found that a very moving moment. Go ahead.
What's interesting about him at that moment is that he has one of the largest tears that I've ever seen rolling down his cheek because he's still remembering his friend who had his face completely blown off and was killed right next to him in the Humvee. Oh. And it's sort of an interesting irony that he's being praised for his service while he's weeping for his lost comrade. And then as the scene continues, they wheel in his other buddy, who was also on a gurney, also half-clothed, and they basically hold each other and weep.
Did every soldier who came to that hospital have the Purple Heart placed on their chest, like was done
no,
to this soldier?
Not all Purple Heart ceremonies are performed that way, although walking around the hospital, you will see a lot of Purple Hearts pinned to pillows. Purple Hearts are rewarded in the field sometimes, back at hospitals in Germany and in the United States. It really depends under what circumstances they think it's best to give you that award. And I think in some ways, it's linked to something that struck me about the entire military structure was the attention to emotional well-being of the soldiers. So that if a commander thought it would somehow be helpful and healing to receive that award, he would present it still as they were recovering from the wounds that they received in combat. And a lot of decisions were made in those moments to try to help soldiers find closure with the horrors they were experiencing. And another thing you see in the film along those lines is the constant presence of a chaplain inside the hospital. Now, that chaplain was responsible for every soldier that came in the door, plus the 350 members of the combat support hospital who were witnessing that horror every day. And he just worked double shifts for every day he was in Iraq. And the Army places as much importance on the spiritual care and the mental care of these soldiers as they do on the physical care. And that was another unexpected thing that I witnessed there in Baghdad.
You mentioned the chaplain. At the end of the film, one of the soldiers in the hospital dies, and the chaplain says a prayer over his body. And what I'd like to do is actually play that prayer, play that scene.
Was he chaplain?
He is no religious preference, sir.
I see. Okay.
So we won't do any
last rites or anything.
Right. Okay. We'll offer just a prayer for his life. And
I'll pray with you.
Yeah, sure, sir.
All right.
Heavenly Father, gracious God, we did everything we could to save his life. The EMT worked very hard, and the surgeons, and Lord, we did everything we could. But Lord, we pray that his life and his death would hasten the cause of peace. This senseless war, this violence here would end, and he would be one of the last. But Lord, again, we pray for your comfort and your peace on his family and his friends. And we say thank you for his life. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.
That's a chaplain in a combat hospital in Baghdad from the new documentary Baghdad ER. You know, the film is it's an apolitical film. It's about what life is like in this hospital. And the only perhaps political moment is when this chaplain refers to this senseless war. And I wasn't sure listening to it quite how to interpret it, whether it was all war seems senseless or this particular war seems senseless to him. Did you ask him about this phrase and what he meant by it?
I asked him very specifically about that for two reasons. And one thing that he said is that I don't think there's anybody here that likes war and celebrates war and likes what war does. And I also asked him if the things that he saw in the hospital ever challenged his faith in God. And there was a second where he couldn't talk. And he sort of looked at me and he seemed to be at a loss for words. And then he said, well, you know, there's always some meaning, even in horrible things like this. But I have to tell you, when you see what war really is like, it shakes you down to your core and makes you question everything that man does to man. And you also look up at the sky and you say, how can something like this be happening? It certainly shook me.
You don't have, like, people having long discussions in the movie about whether the war is succeeding or failing or whether it was a just war to begin with. Were there conversations like that happening away from the camera? Is it something that the doctors or the soldiers talk much about?
They don't talk that much about it because it really isn't that much time for talking. By the time the day is over, they're so exhausted and so covered in blood, they just want to go to sleep. But there is one really interesting moment in the film, and it follows another amputation. A person is losing his arm, and another doctor is looking in the room, and he says, you know, I hope what we're doing over here in Iraq is helping somebody, because if not, this is just sheer madness.
If we ever tried to engage any of the doctors in a political conversation, person after person would not discuss the politics of this war. But what they would say is that we'll never find a war surgeon who likes war. They see the worst of it, and they see the worst of it every day. So they know the real cost of war. And in that sense, of course, they're anti-war, but they're not interested in discussing the politics of it.
My guests are John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill, the directors of the HBO documentary Baghdad ER. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill. Their documentary Baghdad ER will be shown tonight on HBO. They shot the film over the course of 2 months at the Army's 86th Combat Support Hospital in Baghdad. There are times when you went out with the medevac crew to shoot them rescuing injured soldiers. You went out with one group of soldiers looking during the night for IEDs. Trying to, you know, find vehicles or people that might be carrying them. When you were traveling with soldiers who were out doing a mission, what did you try to do so as not to get in their way? And at night, so as not to have the lights that you needed for your cameras either get in the way or betray their presence?
Well, when we shot at night, we shot with a camera that worked with infrared light, and so we had no lights. And so those pictures were produced in total darkness and didn't compromise the safety of the soldiers. And we were very careful not to do anything that would jeopardize any of the missions that we were on. The interesting thing is that even though we were patrolling up and down what's supposed to be the most dangerous street in the world, I felt that was a lot easier than actually being in the hospital. When you're out on the street, the violence is not certain. You aren't going to get shot every single day. Most of the days you'll get through without getting blown up. And you're riding around, you're with soldiers, and there's sort of a feeling of camaraderie. But when you're in the hospital, absolutely every single day that helicopter is going to come in over the horizon and it's going to bring you just terrific carnage. And the relentless delivery of those broken bodies is so psychologically damaging and challenging to people who have to witness it that I actually got out of the hospital and I wanted to ride around on Route Irish rather than be in that emergency room.
Do you think that having the camera in front of your eyes helped distance you in some way from all the carnage that you were seeing in the hospital and enabled you to see it? Like, would it have been harder to see without having the camera between you and the injuries?
I don't know if it was so much the camera or the job, because to have to stand in that room without having a job to do would be humiliating, because everyone around you was moving at 100 miles an hour trying to save somebody's life. And I think it deepened our sense of purpose and responsibility about the story we were going to tell, because this camera that we were holding in our hands was our tool to do something about this situation. And you felt so acutely your responsibility because you were surrounded by doctors who felt responsibility for saving that life. And as far as the technical use of the camera, it was so much easier to worry about how my shot was framed and whether or not I had two channels of audio coming through the camera than it was to actually think about the 19-year-old that was dying in front of the lens.
Do you have nightmares after having seen so much suffering and so many amputations?
You know, the entire time I was in Baghdad, I never had any trouble sleeping because I was so tired whenever I had the opportunity to hit a pillow. But when I got back, I couldn't get some of the images out of my head. And it's one of the things I think about all the time when I think about these soldiers, because I was there as an observer for 2 months, and they spent 12 months of their life there in Baghdad. And in all likelihood, it was either their second time or they'll be going back again. And I can't shake the images that I lived with for those 2 months. And they come back to me at the strangest times. And that's why I think it's so important that we as a country recognize that these are the images that our soldiers are living with when they come back from this war, and recognize that we have to give them the support to deal with these images and deal with these memories for the rest of their lives.
Well, you know, Terry, everybody gets affected in different ways, and I like to think that I'm a tough guy and that I can take all this, but I was flying back on the airplane coming out of Iraq, and they were showing a movie, and I hadn't seen a movie or television in 2 months, and it was some cartoon movie called Stripes about a zebra that competes in the Kentucky Derby and the little girl that took care of him. And as the movie's reaching its conclusion, as the zebra wins the race and the little girl hugs him, I began weeping. I'm actually starting to cry now. I began weeping uncontrollably. And everybody who was sitting next to me on the plane began to look, you know, why is this guy crying about this cartoon movie? And I came back and I told Matt that story. And he had a similar experience on his plane.
And I had the same experience watching an Ashton Kutcher movie where in the end he's singing to his loved, you know, long-lost love with a guitar, a movie that I would usually guffaw at and make fun of, and found myself sitting on this plane with the tears coming down my face. I think, you know, there's so much pent-up emotion from the time that we were there that once we were out, it just came flowing.
John, do you think that's what it was about?
I have to believe that, because you just have to stuff all this stuff deep, deep inside you. Otherwise, you get paralyzed. And there's at the most unexpected time, there's something that triggers those emotions. And I don't cry. And I'm sitting here in the studio right now with tears running down my face. And I'm somewhat embarrassed.
It's the strangest triggers. There's whenever I smell dirty feet, stinky feet, it takes me right back into the emergency room. Because these soldiers would come, these soldiers would come in injured after having been on patrol. And sometimes they wouldn't have had a chance to take a shower or wash their feet for over a week. And I remember vividly one big, strong-looking Marine who is in the film and who lost his life. And he was so strong, and his feet smelled so terrible, just like my feet smell after I've been hiking in the woods or working hard, doing something. And the entire time I was with him, as the doctors fought to save his life, I smelled his stinky feet. And now I'm almost obsessive about keeping my feet clean, because every time I smell bad feet, it takes me back to those that moment and back to that sense of helplessness that there was nothing I could do to help save this Marine's life while all the doctors around had all the skills to try to save him. And I was helpless to do anything. But in the end, they were all helpless to do anything.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us about your movie. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Terry.
John Alpert and Matthew O'Neill directed the documentary Baghdad ER. It will be shown again tonight on HBO. We contacted the Army in the hopes of talking with one of the doctors in the film, but we were told they were too busy to participate. The communications office from the Army did fax us a statement saying, quote, "The Army is extremely proud of the soldiers featured in the film. The Army sponsors approximately 200 documentaries a year, and this documentary captures both the cost of war and the amazing bravery of our men and women who are serving in Iraq. This film contains very real and moving footage of the care of wounded soldiers and the evacuation process. Baghdad ER also highlights the tremendous dedication of all Army soldiers," unquote. Coming up, an interview with photographer David Douglas Duncan about the pictures he wants to serve as photographic headstones for the men who fought and died in Korea. This is Fresh Air. In 1999, David Douglas Duncan received the Lifetime Achievement Award for Excellence in Bravery from the Marine Corps for his work as a war photographer. He was a Marine photographer in World War II. He was one of the first photographers on the scene in the Korean War. He hoped that one day his pictures would be viewed as photographic headstones for the men who fought and died in Korea. His book, This is War, collected his Korean War photos. Many of the pictures were initially published in Life magazine. The photos describe what war is like by focusing on the expressions on men's faces, or as Duncan put it, the look in the man's eyes who is taking his last puff on perhaps his last cigarette before he grabs his rifle and attacks an enemy position. I spoke with Duncan in 1990.
I want to mention some of the photographs that I found just especially moving. One is a sequence of portraits of a Marine who, in the first portrait, there's a...
Leonard Hayworth. He's in the foreground and an old Marine in the background. There are four shots on the double page.
Actually, that's it.
That's what I'm looking for. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's, if you look at it very closely, you'll see something quite surprising, that the only movement in that picture is in the change of expression in Leonard's Hayward's face, the guy in front of me, the Marine, who had come back from the front line, which was about 25 feet away, actually, trying to get more ammunition or a replacement for some of the men who had been wounded. A couple had been killed. There was nothing. It was raining. Nothing. And he cracked up, really cracked up. And the old Marine saw him. He'd been wounded. He sat there. and forgot his own wounds and talked Leonard out of it. He came from a lovely place called Deer Path, Indiana. Can you imagine? He was killed about 3 weeks later.
Another photograph I want to ask you about. This is toward the end of the book in a sequence of photographs of the Marines on retreat. There's a soldier...
Wait a minute. They didn't retreat. They're coming down from the reservoir that's on the border of Manchuria and North Korea. And when you retreat from an enemy force of greater strength which is in front of you. You put them behind you and take off. It happens to be that there were more Chinese communist troopers in front of those Marines than behind them. They fought their way through. They didn't retreat. They fought their way out.
Yeah. Well, in the photograph I'm thinking of, there's a soldier sitting on the hood of a Jeep. There's a rifle on his lap. And the expression on his face, I think, will always stay with me. It looks like, well, kind of looks like he looked into hell, and it left him numb.
He was wounded and frozen and riding because the only way to get him out, if you come out ambulatory, you've tied up a couple of guys, but at least there was still a Jeep running, so he got on the hood of the Jeep. But if you looked to your left, the viewer's left in that photograph, you'll see another Marine who was ambulatory, also wounded, and looking at him with sheer hatred. Can you imagine hating your friend? Because it's an animal factor of survival. It just happens. And the photograph, I think, nailed it down pretty well. But 5 minutes later, it might have changed completely. But that moment, the freezing walking Marine would like to have had a lift on the hood of the Jeep carrying out his friend.
How cold was it?
In the terms of thermometer, it was about 40 below zero Fahrenheit. And in those days, that's 40 years ago, we didn't know about chill factor, but the wind was coming out of Siberia at about anywhere from 25 to 50 miles an hour. So I would imagine the chill factor was somewhere between 60 and 80 degrees below. But, you know, sometimes it comes back, I can't think about it, because I'm thinking the guy's freezing below zero Fahrenheit. It's really strange. It comes back and grabs you by the throat, and you... I'm sitting here fiddling with a paperclip on top of your table in the studio, and I think about those guys of another life.
Dude, have people ever told you that they recognized a husband or a boyfriend?
I'm still getting letters 40 years later from one of those freezing Marines, and everybody from Army, Navy, Air Force, other Marines. I don't know exactly who he was. I know where he was. I know the day. It was taken the 9th of December, just at dawn, on the just below the Yalu River. I know what the temperature was. I know many things, but I don't know. I didn't ask his name. But I was on a program a few days ago, and a call came in from Florida, and a woman was sure it was her husband, except I was sure that it wasn't, because the lady calling identified her husband as having been in the Army. This guy was a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible, except for the rare case where... it doesn't seem to be injurious. I don't tell them. I let them think it's their husband or brother, father. In fact, I got a call from a lady. I live in the south of France. I got a call a couple of months ago at midnight. She didn't realize how late it was where I live. And she was identifying her father, who's a Marine, and he'd gotten the Medal of Honor, the highest decoration given by the military. But he was killed 3 days before I made that picture. So I told her, so she would never be shattered when she discovered that I had been kidding her. So I didn't deceive her. The others I'm not deceiving. I just don't disillusion them.
What are the secrets of shooting in combat without becoming a target yourself?
Well, you are a target, of course. It's a lodger. You know, I'm just lucky. In fact, there's a shot there of Ike Fenton. Ike's a guy with the 1,000-yard stare looking over my shoulder. Ike Fenton, the captain of the assault company up in the beginning. But I tied up with him about a month later during the attack into Seoul, the second chapter of the book. And it had been a terrible night and very cold, strange enough, for September. And I thought shallow foxhole, a lot of stuff coming in, stuff being, that is, rifle fire, a little bit of machine gun, and mortar. So you try to stay as low as you can, very low profile. If you roll over, you might catch it in your shoulder. There's that shallow a foxhole. And It slacked off at dawn, a beautiful dawn, cold, and I stood up to stretch, and I thought I'd pulled a chest muscle. And Ike started to laugh and reached down and held his hand. I held up my fist, and he handled a 30-caliber machine gun slug. This hit me in the chest. At the end of its flight, my dear, as far as it would go, and it hit me, and it dropped without even denting me, nothing. So you say, sometimes you're hit, it doesn't make a difference. Other times you get hit, and it does make a big difference. But I've been lucky. I've just been nicked lightly. I've never been really hit. But the other guys around me, sure.
Do you see these photographs as anti-war photos?
You better believe it. That's why I so object to a politician calling these guys boys. Can you imagine? Some boys.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for your hospitality.
David Douglas Duncan recorded in 1990. His photos are now archived at the University of Texas at Austin. To link to an online exhibition of his work, go to our website at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Julian Hertzfeld is our engineer. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Snakeskin Shamisen, a Maserai mystery by Naomi Hirahara, author of Gasa Gasa Girl. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
During his years in Congress and as vice president, Al Gore tried to call attention to the problem of global warming. He says he thinks he failed to get the message across, but he's getting good reviews for his new film about global warming, An Inconvenient Truth. We'll talk with Gore on the next Fresh Air. Join us.